So my hope is that after each of our talks in this series, that you're going home and thinking a little bit about what you have heard and really applying it to your life. And you may remember that I mentioned at the beginning that there were two kinds of meditation. One is stabilizing meditation to develop concentration, and the other was analytic meditation to develop insight. And when we are contemplating or meditating on the verses in this book, initially we're using the analytic meditation because we might read a verse, remember the teachings on it, the explanation on it, and then close our eyes and think about the explanation, see if it makes sense, apply it to our lives, think about how an understanding of this verse would change how we thought or how we think and behave. Okay, so this analytic meditation involves thinking. Now you might say, well, wait a minute, I thought we weren't supposed to think. Well, when you're doing stabilizing meditation, then you just have your object of meditation, either the figure of the Buddha or the breath or whatever your object is, and you don't think about the object, you just keep the mind focused because your aim is to develop concentration. But in the analytic meditation, you're actively thinking about the teachings in order to understand them. Because when we first hear the teachings, okay, some understanding comes. That's called the wisdom arising from hearing, or the wisdom arising from learning. But that's just an initial kind of wisdom because we've just learned or read or heard the teachings. Okay? And so in order to develop that, we need to sit down and think about the teachings or discuss the teachings with others. Okay, so that's called the wisdom of the wisdom we generate from that is the wisdom of thinking or the wisdom from contemplation. Okay, and then after that, we really focus on the teachings, not only with the analytic meditation, but we combine it together with the stabilizing meditation so that we can remain single-pointedly on what the conclusion of our thought process was. And so that brings a lot of very deep transformation in our mind because we're letting the mind just stay steady on whatever we've understood. Okay? So, for example, in our teachings yesterday, one of the points that Shantideva was making so strongly was how fortunate we are to have a precious human life, and seeing that it's so difficult to attain, if we waste it and fall to the lower realms, then what's going to happen? And especially he was talking about if we give up our bodhicitta and fall to the lower realms, how are we going to benefit anybody else, let alone ourselves? Okay? And so if you were going to go home and meditate on that, you would maybe read one of, you know, the different verses, remember the points in the teaching, and then really think about it. Yeah, and think, okay, I have a precious human life, I have this ability, how am I using my life? Am I using it to practice Dharma? Well, what do I do all day? Well, I go to work. Well, do I have a good motivation when I'm working, or am I working just to get money? I'm working just to get money. That's not such a good motivation. Yeah, where's that motivation going to get me later on? Not anywhere good. So I need to work, So how can I change my motivation to make it a Dharma motivation that propels me to go to work instead of a greedy motivation that propels me to go to work? Okay, so what would a Dharma motivation for going to work be? Okay, well, you think about the clients or the customers, whoever is going to benefit from whatever kind of work you do. And you think of those people and you think, I'm going to work because I really want to benefit those people. I want them to be well and happy. I want them to have a good life. And so I'm going to do my job in order to create happiness for them. Whether I know them or don't know them, whether they thank me or don't thank me, I want to do this. Okay? And so if you think like that each morning before you go to work, then, you know, you have a positive intention for going to work. It's not just a materialistic intention, you know, that is filled with resentment of, oh God, another day, I have to go to work, I can't stand this stuff. The only good thing about it is I get a paycheck. A paycheck. How am I going to spend my paycheck? Okay? So, do you see what that mind is like? Yeah? Is that mind worthwhile to cultivate? No. Okay. But if you really think, I want to benefit the customers, I want to benefit the clients, I want to benefit my colleagues, all the people who are working in the office, I want to be a pleasant person to work with. I want to fill their life with happiness and joy. I don't want to be one of these unpleasant people that everybody writes questions to the Venerable about. You know, all these questions, oh, I'm working with this colleague who's obnoxious. Oh, my boss is too bossy. Oh, my employees don't listen to me. Oh, my colleague doesn't say good morning to me. You know, all these questions. So we don't want to be one of the people who's being written about in those questions. Okay. We want to be the kind of person who goes into our workplace and spreads happiness and helps our colleagues. Yeah, we want to be one of the people who, you know, who goes into work and smiles at the other people we work with in the office or the factory or the school or wherever it is. Yeah, somebody who smiles, who says good morning, who cares about the colleagues, who is a good team player. Yeah, that's the kind of person we want to be. And so we make a strong determination in the morning to benefit the people we're working with as well as the customers and the clients. And so we have a strong motivation to do our work ethically, without cheating, without lying or deceiving. Yeah, we may have a strong motivation that we're not going to talk badly about anybody else behind their back. Can you make that motivation? Can we really say, I'm not going to talk badly about anybody else behind their back? That one's hard, huh? That one hard? That's hard. We like, you know, this person over here, blah, blah. Oh, that person over there, blah. You know? We're working in a team with other people, so we don't do our part, then we blame everybody else. Yeah, we make a scapegoat out of one of the other people in the office and say it's all their fault. Is that the kind of person we want to be? Yeah, it doesn't really get us anywhere, does it? Yeah, it just creates a lot of problems. So, you know, we generate instead in the morning a very strong intention to be kind and to spread goodness and to spread optimism with whoever we encounter during the day. Okay? So that starts actually with our family, which means being a nice family member. Yeah, are we good family members? Yeah, do you look at your children? Yeah, or do you just give them orders? Okay. Do you look at your husband and wife? Or do you just take them for granted and expect them to do all these things for you? Okay. So really taking the time to think, you know, what does it mean to be a good husband? What does it mean to be a good wife? How do I create a good relationship? How do I create a good family? Instead of just taking all these things for granted, to really look at our own behavior and ask ourselves, you know, what am I contributing to the welfare of the family, and how can I increase that? But then one thought in our mind goes, why should I increase the welfare to my family? They aren't reciprocating. They just take me for granted and want me to do this and want me to do that. And what's she telling me to contribute more to my family? They should contribute more to me. So what kind of thought is that? What's that thought? That's the self-centered thought, isn't it? Is that thought our friend? No, that thought is not our friend. Because if we believe that thought, then we're going to be whining in our family and complaining in our family and disagreeable in our family, and then no wonder the other people don't do nice things for us. Because look how we're treating them. So lots of times people come and see me and they say, oh, I have this family problem, I have that family problem. Oh, my husband this, my wife this, my dog, my cat, you know, my kids, my parents, my siblings. Nobody appreciates me. I do so much for them and they only talk bad about me. Okay? Isn't that kind of the warm-up to the pity party? Isn't it? Isn't that attitude just going to lead us into a full-blown pity party, which doesn't get us anywhere? Whereas if we change our mind and think, well, what can I contribute? What can I do? And then we do even small things, even small things for family members, or we do some even small nice things for our colleagues, it can really make a huge difference. Very, very big difference. Lots of times after retreats, people come to me and they say, Buddhism is so great, I benefited so much from this retreat, how can I get it across to my family how wonderful Buddhism is? And so I tell them, take out the garbage. They look at me, you know, because they're expecting me to say, well, you sit down and teach them about karma and nirvana and Buddha, Dharma, Sangha and rebirth, and, you know, that's what they're expecting. I say take out the garbage. Okay. Why? Okay. You go home and your mom's been working in the house, your dad's been doing stuff, there's some garbage, and without them asking, you go and pick up the garbage and you walk down to the chute, you know, and plunk it down. It takes maybe 30 seconds to do that. And your parents stop and they go, oh my goodness. My son, 45 years, I've been waiting for him to take out the garbage. Buddhism is fantastic. Yeah, he went to a Buddhist course and he came and took out the garbage. I love Buddhism. Yeah. So really, you know, these small things that we do can be the best way to really show others about the value of the Dharma. Just to share an experience with you, my mother passed away in November, and none of my family is Buddhist. They all thought I was a little bit weird, maybe a lot weird. Okay. But when we were at the mortuary, I went with my brother and my dad in to see my mother's body. And I had brought with me some blessed pills, and I had, you know, mantra and prayers and things that I wanted to say. And so in the mortuary room, you know, we were there, and my brother was quite upset, and I was kind of, he's my little brother, but he's that much taller than me. So I was comforting him. And then I started doing the mantras and prayers. And my brother is not at all religious. In fact, you know, he thinks his sister is a little bit odd. But I did all these prayers and everything like that. And then at the end, to my great surprise, he said, "If I die before you, will you do that for me?" And I was so touched, you know? I was really touched because he had never had any appreciation for the Dharma before until just that small thing that I did for our mother. And then it was like, yeah? So just things like that can sometimes really change other people's attitudes and change relationships. So I was even more surprised when my brother said that, in fact, he suggested at the memorial service that I say that I do some Buddhist prayers publicly. You know, of course, the rabbi nixed that idea. I wasn't able to do it, but I was quite surprised, you know, that my brother had suggested it. So, you know, you never know what's going to happen, and sometimes just small things that you do can really change the energy between you and another person. They have a bumper sticker in the U.S. that says, "Do random acts of kindness." So just think, as you go throughout your day, what are random acts of kindness that I can do for other people? You know, for family members, for colleagues, for even strangers. Okay, so this is if we think like this and set our motivation like this, then we are actively combating that demon of our self-centered thought. Okay, that mind that's always saying, me, 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 me. Okay, because instead we're really opening our heart and thinking about others. Today, I went to Suchi Foundation in Singapore. My Chinese isn't very good. How do you say it? Suchi? 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 You know which one I'm talking about, okay? And I was so impressed what they were doing. Of course I knew about it beforehand, and I had met their master in 1986 when I was in Taiwan. But it was just so inspiring to see how they are really committed to being of benefit to others, and how much joy the volunteers there take in benefiting others. And they had such a good attitude because they were really commenting that when they go to either on an international relief service or they're doing some work in Singapore, they say that they approach it with the idea that they are learning from the person who they're supposedly helping. And that's really true, because if we open our heart and extend our care and affection, you know, to the poor, to the needy, yeah, even to our family, for goodness sake, or our boss, yeah, if we open our heart in this way, it can bring so many blessings, because we're connecting with other people in a really wonderful way. And instead of seeing us as doing something for them, we see them as benefiting us. And so this is a really key concept when we're acting with compassion and cultivating compassion, is to see ourselves and whoever it is that we're supposedly helping as equals and as mutually benefiting each other. Because if we go into a situation thinking, I am benefiting you, because I am a very together person and you are a slob who can't get your life together and does everything wrong, but I am so kind and compassionate that I'm going to help you, you poor jerk. Yeah? That's often how we are, you know, and we think we're being so compassionate. That's not compassion, that's condescension. Yeah, big difference between condescension and compassion. Shantideva in this text, not in the chapter we're studying now, but in a later chapter, there's a verse in which he talks about the attitude we should have when we're practicing the Bodhisattva trainings, when we are supposedly benefiting others. And he said, it should be like the hand pulling a thorn out of the foot. That's how we should help others. So if you think about it, when you step on a thorn and your foot hurts, you immediately stop, lift up your leg, the hand reaches down, pulls out the thorn. If you need to bandage it, you do. If you don't, you wash it. And you go on, and that's the end of it. Okay? That's how the hand helps the foot. The hand doesn't go, I am the beautiful, wonderful hand, and you foot are so lowly, and I, the great and glorious hand, am going to help you. So now you owe me a favor. And now you better tell everybody how good I am. The hand doesn't do that. The hand just does it, takes the thorn out of the foot automatically. And so it is when we see suffering, okay? Suffering is suffering. It's something to be eliminated, whether it's our suffering or the other person's suffering. And when we do something, we just do it naturally, without expectation, without wanting a thank you, and we see that other person as teaching us, and we see that other person as kind because they're giving us the opportunity to create merit. They're giving us the opportunity to fulfill our bodhisattva aspiration. Communicating, it's a very different idea than we usually have when we help others, isn't it? But if we train our mind to think like this, then helping others can be very natural, just as if we were helping ourselves. And in addition, we learn something from it. So I was very impressed with the Suchi volunteers that, you know, this is exactly what their attitude is. And one other thing that I thought I'd share with you that I learned today, because we were talking the other day about how sometimes we want to help somebody, but they're not ready to accept our help. And then we feel hurt, we feel angry, we feel neglected. I'm being so kind, wanting to help you, and you're not listening to me. Okay. So one of the women there was telling me today that one time she was doing a home visit to somebody who was sick, and the man got very angry at her and started shouting at her. Okay, so here she is going into his home to help, and he's just irate and screaming at her. And she said she kept her cool, she didn't scream back, she didn't feel hurt or angry. But she said to him, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. Please tell me what it is that you need." And the man stopped, and he was so surprised that somebody even wanted to listen to him. Yeah, because apparently he was so used to people coming in who wanted to help, but in fact were bossing him around, that he was surprised that somebody else actually wanted to listen to him say how they could help him. And so then he did, and then she did that. Yeah. So I thought, what a wonderful way when we encounter that kind of situation where we're thinking to help somebody, you know, they're not accepting it, and instead of feeling hurt or angry or unappreciative, we say, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. Tell me what it is you need. Tell me what it is you want." In other words, you tell me how I can help you. I'm not going to come in with my ideas and my agenda of what you need. Okay? So all this, you know, all these kinds of things are ways in which we chip away at our self-centered attitude and cultivate an open heart that really wants to help others. And when with that open heart, then we really connect with other people. And after that, we never feel lonely. We never feel desperate or despair, because we're communicating with others on a really heart-to-heart level. Okay, so let's continue with our text. I've got to get my glasses. So we were on verse 17. Okay. "With such behavior on my part," in other words, if we're being lazy or negligent or so on, "with such behavior on my part, a human state is certainly not obtained again. When a human state is not achieved, there is only vice. So how could there be blessing? Or how could there be virtue?" So what this verse is saying is when we are lazy or when we follow our self-centered thought and create a lot of negative karma, then we will not have a human rebirth. We will not obtain a human rebirth in the future life. And when this human rebirth isn't attained, then we fall to the lower realms, then it's very difficult to create virtue. And instead, we get very involved in creating negative actions. So remember I was telling you yesterday or the day before about my cats and how much I tried to teach them about the first precept, not to kill, and they don't listen? So, you know, having fallen to a lower rebirth, then with the kind of body they have, then that's what comes naturally, and they create negative karma rather easily. So we don't want to wind up in that situation ourselves. 18, if I do not perform virtue, even when I am capable of it, what then shall I do when fully dazed by the suffering of miserable states of existence? So as human beings, when we're capable of doing virtuous actions, when we have the opportunity to be generous, but instead we're stingy, when we have the opportunity to abandon the 10 non-virtues, but instead we practice them, when we have the opportunity to develop patience and fortitude, but instead we, you know, stay stuck in our anger, when we have the opportunity to meditate on love and compassion, but instead we watch television, when we have the opportunity to learn about the ultimate nature of reality, but instead we go on the computer and play computer games. Okay, so in that kind of situation, okay, we're not performing virtue even when we're capable of it. And so how do we think we're going to do virtuous activities once we're born in the lower realms? Yeah. Even we're born as a cat in my abbey, which is a pretty good rebirth for an animal, you know, still very difficult to create virtue. We try and we have a Buddha statue in our garden. We try and get the cats to circumambulate it, but we have to hold out some food to get them to follow us. Okay. So difficult to create virtue when you're born in an animal realm. Okay, verse 19, for one who does not perform virtue but accumulates negativity, even the expression favorable state of existence will be lost for 1,000,000,000 eons. So if we don't take care and practice virtue but instead just let our mind do whatever it wants to do and create a lot of negativity, then having fallen into a rebirth in the hells or as a hungry ghost or as an animal, then even the expression of favorable state of an existence won't be something that we'll hear. So what are the non-virtues, the negativities that we want to abandon? Well, especially we want to abandon giving up bodhicitta. So remember we were talking about how if we give up bodhicitta, it's like deceiving all the sentient beings to whom we've made the promise to help them towards enlightenment. So we want to abandoning bodhicitta. Okay. We also want to abandon the 10 non-virtues. So taking life, taking what isn't given to us, or stealing, unwise or unkind sexual behavior. I won't say that now. Then lying, to abandon lying, Then to abandon creating disharmony with our speech. To abandon harsh speech, ridiculing, yelling at people, cursing them, swearing at them. To abandon idle talk. And then to abandon coveting things that belong to others. To abandon malice, ill will towards others, and to abandon wrong views, such as thinking that there's no such thing as Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, or that sentient beings are inherently selfish and there's no way to eliminate our self-centered thought, these kinds of wrong views. So those are the negativities we want to abandon. Yeah. And then the things we want to practice are, first of all, not doing the negative ones. So just not doing the negative ones is in itself a virtuous action. Okay. Then in addition, if we consciously protect life, protect others' property, yeah, use sexuality wisely and kindly, or remain celibate, okay, tell the truth, use our speech to create harmony, speak kindly, speak at appropriate times and of proper subjects, yeah, cultivate generosity, cultivate love, and cultivate correct views. Okay? So if we put our energy into doing those 10 virtues, then our lives are becoming very meaningful, because not only now are we living in a very good way, but we're putting so many positive karmic seeds in our mind stream that will ripen in goodness and good rebirth and the opportunity to practice the Dharma in future lives. So we have our work cut out for us, don't we? Okay, 20. Therefore, the Blessed One stated that human existence is extremely difficult to obtain, like a turtle's head emerging into the ring of a yoke on a vast ocean. So this is an analogy that you find both in the Pali Sutras and the Mahayana or Sanskrit Sutras, that a precious human life is like a blind turtle at the bottom of an ocean who comes up to the surface of the ocean once every 100 years. And there's a golden ring that's floating in this huge ocean. Okay. And so the golden ring is going here and going there and everywhere. And the turtle is blind. It comes to the surface of the ocean once every 100 years. How likely is it that the turtle, when it comes up, is going to put its head through the golden yoke? Not very likely. Okay. It's like the chance of winning money at the casino you guys are building. Not very likely. Yeah. Not good for your family. Yeah. So, if attaining the kind of life that we have now is so rare, then we should really make use of it, because that turtle, if he finally gets his head through that yoke, you know, he should make use of it. Yeah. The Tibetans tell these really funny stories about, at least I consider them funny, about how happy we should feel having a precious human life. So one of the stories is about a person who is on the edge of a cliff, and he has no arms and no legs, and he falls off, and he falls onto the back of a horse who is galloping along, and he sits on the back of the horse for a horse ride, saying, "Oh, how fortunate I am." Yeah, you thought it was as funny as I did. You want to hear another one they use? Because in Tibet, you know, there's no oceans. They're very far from the ocean. So they don't eat fish very much. So there's a story of the man who ate fish and thought that it was so delicious that he ate it and ate it and ate it and ate it. And then he felt sick to his stomach, but he didn't want to throw it up because it was so precious. So he tied a rope around his neck. Yeah, that's what I thought of it too. Okay. But the point is that we have a precious human life, and so let's feel happy about it and let's make good use of it. Okay. Maybe a more modern example of how happy we should feel about having our present opportunity would be somebody giving you a credit card that is in their name and has unlimited ceiling. Okay, so, oh, you would like that one, wouldn't you? Yeah, credit card, I buy this, I buy that. They pay for it, let's go for it. Okay, so that, you want to even feel happier than that when you think, I have a precious human life because I have the chance to create virtuous karma. That's so much more valuable than having an unlimited charge on somebody else's credit card. Okay, much more valuable than that. Really? You have unlimited charge on a credit card? Yeah, you're going to come home with all this stuff that's going to clutter your house, that's going to break, that's going to be a pain in the neck. Yeah. And in the process, you've accumulated a lot of negative karma out of greed. And when you die, none of that stuff's going to go with you, but your negative karma out of greed will. Okay, so in actual fact, finding that credit card from a Dharma point of view isn't so valuable. But finding a precious human life with the ability to practice is incredibly valuable. Verse 21, one dwells in the avicca hell for an eon as a consequence of a vice committed in a single moment. What then can be said of a favorable state of existence, since negativity has been accumulated since beginningless time? Okay, so we might dwell in the lowest state of hell for an eon, long time, as a result of a negative action that we did in a single moment. That's pretty powerful, isn't it? Yeah. One lie that we tell, some harsh words that we say to somebody, this kind of thing, you know, if we do with a full motivation and an object and we are really into doing the action, we complete the action, we rejoice at it, you know, such a thing that we do in a moment, boing, yeah, can be the cause for a lower rebirth that lasts an eon. So if that's the situation, then how likely is it for us to get a good rebirth, considering that we've been accumulating negativities since beginningless time? Yeah. So we see that, you know, if we have a big stock of negativity, it's very easy for some of that to ripen and not the good karma. And so in which case we would miss having the opportunity to have a precious human life next rebirth. Okay. So understanding that, we should be concerned, not panicky, not freaked out, but we should kind of wake up and go, oh, you know, this is something important here. It's important for me to put my time into Dharma practice, and it's not important for me to put my time into ignorance, anger, and attachment. Okay, so understanding this helps us make a very strong motivation. 22. Having experienced that alone, one still is not liberated. Therefore, while experiencing it, one begets more vices. Okay, so while we're experiencing a lower rebirth that is the result of our own negative karma, it's not you know, that the result of that negative karma is being experienced, so that negative karma is getting exhausted. Yeah. However, when we're in that suffering state, it's so easy for us to create more negativity because we're in such a miserable situation. So it's not that we're just purifying negativity by having a bad rebirth, but we're in a situation where it's very easy to actively create more negative karma. Okay? Because think about it. If we're in a very suffering situation, then it's easy to get angry, isn't it? When it's easy to get angry, then it's easy to create karma out of anger. When we're in a situation where we lack food or lack clothing, then it's easy to have a lot of desire and steal other people's things. Okay? So you see, in that kind of situation, it's not that you're just experiencing the fruition of negative karma by living in poverty, but that situation itself, it is very easy for us to generate more new negative karma. Okay? So understanding that, we shouldn't just think, oh, well, if I create some negativity now, I'll have a lower rebirth later on, but it won't last very long, and after that I'll have another human rebirth again easily. It's not quite like that. Okay? So these verses are to counteract any wrong kind of thinking that we have, that, well, it's no big deal, you know, be born a cat at Shravasti Abbey, you know, be born a mouse at Shravasti Abbey, no big deal. Yeah, well, it is a big deal, yeah, because it's hard to have, you know, come out of that again. Okay, verse 23, upon obtaining such leisure, that means the leisure of a precious human life, if I do not practice virtue, then there is no duplicity greater than this, and there is no delusion greater than this. So when I have the leisure to create virtue, which a precious human life gives us, if we don't practice virtue, then we're cheating on ourselves. Okay? It's duplicity, but we're our own object. We're cheating ourselves. Okay? So there's no greater way to cheat ourselves. There's no greater way to delude ourselves. Okay? So it's like that person who has that credit card in somebody else's name, and they could go to Orchard Road and buy everything they want, but instead they throw the credit card in the gutter. Okay. So, yeah, that's what this verse is saying. Yeah, when we have the leisure. Now, you might say, what do you mean leisure? How does this life have leisure? I don't have leisure. I'm stressed. Yeah, my family's stressed. My work is stressed. I'm so stressed. You know, I don't have time to do anything. I don't even have time to go to Dharma class. I'm so stressed. Okay. You still have leisure. From a Buddhist viewpoint, you still have leisure. It's your mind that is making you stressed. Not the external environment. The environment isn't making us stressed. It's our deluded mind that is reacting to the environment by getting stressed. Because it is possible to be in the same environment and not be stressed. You're going to say, oh, but I have to do this and I have to do that. And if I don't do this, my boss is going to say this. If I don't do that, And in the process of getting yourself stressed like that, you're actually less productive, aren't you? Okay, because what your energy isn't going into doing your work, your energy is going into being worried and stressed. So totally useless. Yeah. Whereas even if there's a lot of things to do, you just say, you in your mind, you prioritize things. What are the things that are most important for you to do? So you have to start by thinking clearly about what's important to be done, in what order. And then you start at the top of your list and you start doing those things. Yeah. And if you don't get through your list, then, you know, you go to the people and you say, I'm sorry, I wasn't able to do that. Or you do that before the deadline and say, I have a number of other things to do. I'll do what you ask me, you know, when the time appears. And so in that way, you don't need to get all stressed and frenetic. Getting what I'm saying? Yeah. We're kind of professional stressors. But it's really not very useful. Okay. Verse 24, if I recognize this and still deludedly fall into sloth, then when I am commanded by the messengers of Yama, I shall long remain in great anguish. The messengers of Yama, that is a metaphor for death. Okay? So if I recognize my situation, but instead I still fall into sloth, okay, then what's going to happen to me when I die? Now you're going to say, but I don't fall into sloth. I'm stressed out because I'm doing this and I'm doing that and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. I'm not falling into sloth. Actually, from a Buddhist viewpoint, when we're very busy running here and there doing worldly activities, that's called being lazy. Yeah, we usually think being lazy means that you don't set your alarm clock and you oversleep. Mm-mm. Being lazy, from a Dharma viewpoint, means wasting our time doing things that don't have any long-term benefit. Yeah, wasting our time on video games and computer games and going to the movies and getting stressed out and going to parties and drinking and drugging and, you know, these kinds of things. That's considered laziness. Running from one social activity to the next, from one party to the next, that's considered laziness. Because we're not practicing the Dharma. We're lazy in terms of our Dharma practice. Okay? So, if that's the situation, we fall into that kind of sloth, then when the time comes to die, what happens? Yeah, then we're really in trouble, you know, and our mind really freaks out because we start looking at our life and say, what have I done in my life? What's been of benefit in my life? Yeah. And instead, all we see is a whole string of negative actions. And then a deep sense of regret and remorse comes. And at the time of death, it's too late to do anything about it because we're dying. Yeah. And the karma for the next rebirth is ripening, and there we go. Okay, so the time to practice is now while we're alive. So remember yesterday somebody in the questions said, what's wrong with wanting to raise our family and have our career and then practicing Dharma later? And I said, because you might not live that long. Yeah, and how everybody laughed. We all thought that was so funny. But it's true, isn't it? And if we think about it, we laughed because we knew it was true. Verse 25, the unendurable fire of hell will scorch my body for ages, and afterwards the fire of remorse will torment my undisciplined mind for a long time. Okay, so if we fall into a lower rebirth, we have physical suffering, but sometimes I think even greater than physical suffering is our mental suffering. know, and especially the mental suffering of having remorse. And so that's why it's so important that we do purification practices now to counteract the misdeeds that we've done in this life. Because we've all made mistakes, haven't we? Every single one of us. Yeah, the 10 negative actions I just went through, I've done all 10. Yeah. So it's, you know, there's something to pay attention to here. Yeah. But if we just ignore that fact and go on as if we aren't going to die and that karma is not going to bring its results, that's being really stupid. But if we look at the things we've done and we have the courage to admit honestly what our mistakes are, okay, and we imagine the Buddha Dharma Sangha and we confess and, you know, without trying to cover things up and have a sincere sense of regret, a determination not to do it again, take refuge and generate bodhicitta, and then do some kind of anecdotal behavior, then we can purify all that karma. And then we just go on in our lives feeling very joyful because we've purified our karma and we've learned from our past mistakes. Okay. You know how old people are sometimes very bent over? Yeah, we usually think it's because of osteoporosis or arthritis or something. But sometimes I wonder if they're bent over because what weighs on their back is all the mistakes they've made in life that they haven't confessed and haven't purified. Yeah? Sometimes we meet old people who are very bitter, who are very sad, and I think it's because, you know, they haven't attended to the purification process that's so important. So that's why I think it's really important. If we do purification, then we don't have to carry guilt and remorse and regret around with us. But instead, we learn from our mistakes, we set a new intention to go forward in a good way, and then our life proceeds in a very nice way, and we can stand up straight because we don't have the weight of our negativities on our back. Okay. So I'll just do the next verse and then we'll stop. So it says, I have somehow obtained the advantageous state that is very difficult to achieve. And though aware of it, I am led back to those same hells. Okay. So that's being foolish. Yeah, we have such a beautiful, wonderful rebirth that we really need to appreciate it and take advantage of it. So we're going to stop here for today and do some Q&A. And tomorrow night is a public talk. So you're come and bring your friends and relatives and everybody else. And I was thinking, because remember last night I said that there were these very beautiful verses talking about the disadvantages of the afflictions, and those are the next set of verses that we have here. Okay, so I'm thinking, I'm not sure yet, but I'm thinking maybe tomorrow to talk a little bit about those verses. Because it's something that even people who come to a public talk who haven't heard the beginning part of the chapter can understand. Okay, so now we can have some question and answer. So you can write things down or come to the mic. And I also have a pile from the last two nights. Oh, hold on a second.
There you go. Venerable, is it okay? Okay. Thank you for your insightful talk. I really enjoyed it. I'm just asking something about the verse 26, but it says, we were just discussing about the advantageous human rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand the last part that says, I am led back to those same hells.
Mm-hmm.
So when it says, I have somehow obtained the state that is very difficult to achieve, and though aware of that, I'm led back to those same hells. Could you explain that I am led back to those same hells?
Oh, okay. What it's talking about, what it means in verse 26, I am led back to the same hells, is that in previous lives, due to our own negative karma, we have been born in the hell realm. Having that negative karma having got exhausted, now we have the fortune to have a precious human life, which is the ripening of our own good karma. So having this precious human life now, if we then use it to create negativity that send us back to the same hell realms, then it's very foolish.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you.
That reminds me, one time I was, one of my teachers came to Los Angeles when I was there, and we took him to the Santa Monica Beach. Okay, so this old Tibetan Lama at the Santa Monica Beach, and he was, there were lots of sea urchins there, you know, the ones where you put something in and they close up. So he took his mala, his prayer beads, and he would like go and touch all these different sea urchins. I felt like he was kind of blessing them with his mala. And then he looked around at all of these people who were lying in their bikinis and swimsuits on the beach. And then, you know, going in and going surfing or swimming and coming out and lying on the beach. And he said, it took them so long to get out of a rebirth in the water, and now they just want to go back in. Yeah? So that's kind of like this verse, you know, we got out of the hell realms and then we do things that send ourselves back there. Okay. Anything else? Okay, I'll start on the one here. Dear teacher, how can Buddhism cure or help insomnia? I had some friends in UK that told me whenever they listened to my Dharma tapes, they fell asleep. So I guess that could be a cure for insomnia. I think that it's important, you know, to have the mind relaxed before we go to sleep. Yeah, so if we do some purification before we go to sleep, then we let go of whatever tumultuous emotions or confusion we've had during the day, and then we can go to sleep much more easily. Yeah. But I do find, and sometimes when I can't sleep very well, if I say mantra, then, you know, just the steady tone of the mantra makes it easy for the mind to relax and go to sleep. Okay. If you want to write anything or ask anything, please do, otherwise I'll go through. Okay, how to generate bodhicitta within oneself? That is a question that takes a long time to answer. Okay, excellent question. What I'd like to do is I'll outline the two methods for generating bodhicitta, but I would also like to refer you to the book by one of my teachers, Geshe Jampa Tekshot, called Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage. I think it's out there. And also in Taming the Mind, it talks too about these methods for generating bodhicitta. So one method is called the 7-point cause and effect instruction. So here, preliminary to these 7 points, you practice equanimity, that is, equalizing the mind so that we don't have attachment to friends, aversion to enemies, and apathy to strangers. So that's the prelude. Okay. Then the seven points of cause and effect. There's six causes and one effect. So the six causes are first seeing all sentient beings as our mother, remembering their kindness, wanting to repay their kindness, having heartwarming love towards them, then having compassion. Then sixth is having a great resolve to really bring them happiness and eliminate their suffering. And then as a result of those six steps, the seventh point is the bodhicitta. Okay, so that's the outline for how to generate that system. As I said in Geshe Jampa Tekchok's book, chapter 10, he goes into this in depth in a really beautiful explanation. And then chapter 11, he talks about the other way of generating bodhicitta. And that's the way that's also explained in this book. Okay, and it's called equalizing and exchanging self for others. So here first, you equalize self and others, realizing everybody wants happiness and doesn't want suffering. Okay. Then you think of the disadvantages of the self-centered thought. Then you contemplate the benefits of cherishing others. Then you exchange yourself and others in the sense of we exchange who we consider to be most important. In our normal state, we consider ourselves important and others not important. When we exchange self and others, then we think of ourselves as not quite so important and as others' welfare is really important. Okay? Then after that, we do what's called the taking and giving meditation, where we imagine taking on suffering with compassion and giving others happiness with love. And then from there, we generate bodhicitta. So they're both very wonderful ways for cultivating bodhicitta. Actually, you know, if you want more depth, more description of this, if you go to www.tutanchudran.org and you look under the section that says other commentaries, there's a commentary on the three principal aspects of the path. And in there, one of the three principal aspects of the path is how to develop bodhicitta. So there's a whole series of talks there that go through these two methods. Okay. If you can't remember the website, if you pick up an Abbey brochure on your way out, the website's URLs are there and you can get them. You talked about how to get into depression. How do you get out of it? Very good question. I think, first of all, prevention is the best medicine. And the way to prevent depression is to have a very positive attitude. In other words, to do a lot of meditation on the kindness of others, so that we begin to see beauty in the other people around us. I think that's one way to prevent depression and to also help get our mind out of depression. Another way is contemplating the precious human life and all the conditions that give us this kind of life, how rare it is to have it, and the great benefit we can accomplish. Because when we think about that, then again our mind becomes very joyful. Also contemplating the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is a really nice way to make the mind uplifted, because when we think that there are really beings in the universe like Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, then we automatically feel very happy and a lot of delight, and especially when we think if we practice, we can become like that. And then another meditation that I think is very helpful in depression is to do the visualization. So for example, visualizing the Buddha in front of us and then thinking of light coming from the Buddha coming into us, absorbing in through the pores of our body, or coming in through the crown of our head and filling our whole body and mind, and then just dwelling with this awareness of the Buddha's love and compassion filling us up in the form of light and nectar. I think that's also a very good antidote to depression. But all these meditations that I'm describing are things that you have to practice over time. Don't think that if you do it for 5 minutes, your depression is gone. You have to put some energy into it. Okay? So if we're surrounded by a short fused boss, a stressful environment, and a difficult surrounding, is it because of our bad karma that we're in this situation? Well, you know, for some people, they would look at that situation and say, my goodness, what good karma you have. You live in Singapore, and you have a job, and you get a paycheck. I live in Darfur. I'm homeless. There's genocide in my country. I don't have food. What are you talking about, a difficult situation? Yeah? You see what I'm saying? This only becomes a difficult situation if you hold in mind the ideal job that you want to have. If you hold in mind how many people in this world live, what is your difficult situation is their heavenly situation. And they would trade in a blink of an eye, they would trade with you. Yeah, to have the education you have, the skills you have, you know, short fused boss, no problem. Boy, there's a job in a clean country with health care. Wow, enough food. That person would change with you very quickly. Okay? So this, you know, these kind of situations really illustrate to me how our mind always finds something to be unhappy about. Yeah? No matter what situation we're in, we find something to be unhappy about. So even if you had a good boss, a not stressful environment, and a good surrounding, as long as we have ignorance, anger, and attachment, we're going to complain about something. You know, this is just our samsaric mind, isn't it? So I guess in one way, if you forget about the person in Darfur, you can say that you're living in this situation as a result of negative karma. But in another way, you know, having a job and a paycheck and food and health care, life in a country like this, is a result of a lot of good karma. Okay, so some people do religious activities such as offering pujas at the funeral services and doing generosity, but they don't practice the Dharma. Is this the correct way to practice Buddhism? Okay, well, we have to actually understand what's going on here. If somebody is just doing a puja, you know, when they have a bell and they have a drum, and they're ringing the bell and beating the drum, and their mind's just going blah, 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 thinking, oh, you know, this person's going to give me some donation for doing this. Well, that's not religious practice. Okay. But somebody else can be doing puja at a funeral and have a real sense of love and compassion for the person who died and really want them to have a good rebirth. They could have love and compassion for the grieving family members and want to benefit the family members by doing puja for the deceased loved one. And so then when that person is doing the chanting, they're really focusing on the meaning of what they're saying. They're doing the meditation that accompanies the chanting, the visualization, the generation of love and compassion, and so on. And so that person might be doing the same kind of thing, but they have a wonderful motivation, and by doing the meditation, actually their own mind is getting transformed. So that is Dharma practice. Okay? So we can't just tell by what it looks like on the outside. We have to see what's going on the inside. Okay, so if any kinds of animals follow you around a pagoda or a stupa, is this helpful for them having a good rebirth? It is, actually. There's a story in the sutras about a very old man, and his family was tired of having him around, and so they kind of sent him out, and he thought, well, might as well become a monk. Yeah. So he started out with not such a good motivation. And he went to, I believe it was Shariputra, and asked for ordination. But Shariputra didn't excel in having psychic powers. And so when he looked, he couldn't see that this old man had created enough good karma that would warrant his being able to become a monk. And so he told him no. So the old man just was completely forlorn and desperate, and he started to cry and sob because he was refused ordination. And the Buddha came along and said, "What's happening? Why are you so upset?" And the old man told him. And then the Buddha, with his clairvoyant powers, because the Buddha is omniscient, was able to see that one time, many eons ago, when this old man had been born as a fly, he had landed on a piece of cow dung. And there had been a stupa, and around the stupa was kind of like a moat or some water, and this piece of cow dung with the fly on top of it was floating around the stupa, okay? And so just by that, you know, good karma of having contact with a holy object, that kind of gave him the karmic boost so that he could be ordained. So yeah, it does benefit animals by taking them around stupas. It benefits them to chant and have them hear you, or to take, like if you took this book and read it out loud so that animals or insects heard it, it puts good imprints on their mind stream. So that's very helpful. Okay, so we have to stop for this evening. Lots of questions. And let's just do a little digestion meditation. Okay? So let's think about what we heard and think about how we can put it into practice in our life. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.